As we said, for those of you who are joining us, we're here for the very first seminar in an seven-part series that we're doing here on clueing in the month of August to help focus or highlight attention on the triad approach. And we're actually hosting this seminar series as part of a redelivery of a number of events that were or training sessions that were given at the National Triad Conference and Training Session that was delivered last year at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, where approximately 260 people gathered from the U.S. and abroad to actually discuss the triad approach to help conduct investigations or remedial actions for faster, better, and at a reduced cost. There's a functional group called the Triad Community of Practice who decided to update and repackage a number of these sessions to help benefit the greater Cluin audience that either weren't able to go to the sessions or not able to attend specific presentations while at the conference. By doing this, that they're hoping that our audience can learn more about the Triad tools and see how they've been applied by colleagues in the environmental industry. So this very first session is the first in a series of seven that will collectively comprise Triad Month here on Cluin. During this very first two-hour seminar, we're going to introduce you to the basic elements of the triad approach and process. This seminar, which is primarily for managers and non-technical staff, will describe processes for improving the performance of the project during setup, site characterization, remediation, reuse, and will provide numerous how-to examples of the triad processes. The instructors for today's event will include Robert Howe with Tetra Tech EMI and Kim Takasaki of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So again, I'd like to thank everyone, remind you to keep your phone lines on mute, and I will turn things over, starting on slide number one, to Kim.
Great. Thanks, Jean, and thank you all for coming. I've noticed on the sign-in list we've got people all over the world here today, so I really appreciate your time and your interest. As Jean has said, my name is Kim Takasaki. I'm with the Seattle District Army Corps of Engineers, and I've been with federal government for 8 years, and before that in private industry for six. I've been doing triad pretty much that entire time, and so I'm very happy to be here today to give you a little bit of introduction to triad. Moving to the second slide, what we're hoping to accomplish today is to give you just the basics, the basic components of triad. We only have about an hour and a half today and then with time for questions. So we're hoping that you're going to be able to walk away today being able to describe what those components are, the benefits associated with using the process, explaining some key vocabulary, things like consensus, vision, dynamic work strategies, so you'll be able to see what those keywords are when you do encounter a project. And I guess the bottom line would be to really be able to identify for yourself when and if you feel like this process could be used in the work that you're doing. So slide three. What is triad? Triad is not an acronym. It actually means three things. So if you imagine triad being three legs, you have systematic project planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement technologies. All of those are focused on managing uncertainty in environmental investigations. EPA has derived this compilation of these three things to be able to synthesize what the experiences of successful projects have been for environmental investigations as a way to help you guys more effectively manage your day-to-day work. Systematic planning helps with managing the uncertainty by achieving consensus vision with all the stakeholders. So up front, you do a lot of discussion about what are everyone's needs and how are you going to manage the uncertainty associated with those needs. And then the combination of the dynamic work strategies and the real-time analytics are related to the actual site characterization piece of managing the uncertainty. And you'll probably recognize a lot of the things that we're talking about today. The concept is that if you see all three of them together, there's actually a great power in all three together, but you will recognize components probably in the work that you already do. And this is almost, it's a rearticulation of the EPA DQO process. So a lot of this stuff may be familiar to you already. So why did EPA feel like they had to develop and promote this concept? If you think about what you do on a day-to-day basis, this is slide four. You will see that you have this typical project lifestyle cycle of doing environmental investigation, characterization, remedial design, remedial action, and that there's just the same process I'm sure we're all familiar with. Moving to slide five, what happens, though, is that within each phase, you actually have, oftentimes, site investigation associated with each. And so if you start looking at the timeline and life cycle, for all of those stages in this traditional approach, you can see that, and I'm sure you guys have all experienced, that you know, as you're going through the process, you have another loop and then another loop and then another loop. And so the objective of the triad process, this is slide 6, would be to try to reduce that cycle. You could, with systematic planning, you identify the data that you need with consideration for subsequent phases such as RDRA. And then with real-time analytics and dynamic work strategies, you can actually accomplish the same amount of work with less field mobilizations. So that's the fundamental concept behind Triad. It's all about streamlining your existing work and managing your uncertainties. So moving to slide 7, what we're going to do for the rest of the presentation is go through each of the components and give you some examples about what these actually look like. Systematic planning is the first phase. I would say this is the one that has the most impact in terms of managing uncertainty. It can be any process that you use to build the consensus vision for conducting your environmental investigation. There are some guidance documents on the triadcentral.org website if you're looking for a checklist as to what types of topics you should be talking about. But the primary goal here in systematic planning is whatever you want to do to get folks on the same page and to make sure that you're all having building the consensus vision so that you understand what other people's perspective is. This does not mean that you all have to walk away with the same vision. It may be that you decide that you have alternative visions of what the site is, what's going on in the site, and that's okay. And then you can actually focus your site investigation activities to help resolve the uncertainties associated with those different visions. So generally, what does a systematic planning activity look like? First of all, you have to assemble all the stakeholders to create a core technical team. Now, this would include, you know, from a regulatory perspective, all your regulators, whether it's state, federal, any other interested parties, if there's developers, the people that are actually going to be doing the work, the consultants. And the key difference with this is that you also have your technical team. So from any perspective, having the appropriate staff, like the risk assessor, the geologist, the chemist, people that are going to be able to contribute to whatever you're going to be talking about in that conversation. And then, was there a question? Okay. Within that systematic planning activity, the key things that you'll be doing would be to identify what the decisions are that you needed to be made, and then the most important thing is defining an exit strategy, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. It really all that is how are you going to know when you're done for this phase and for the project as a whole? Essentially, what will the future look like? And then you have to consider within that framework what are the appropriate regulatory and risk-based criteria that will help you form knowing when you will be done. And then most important piece of the systematic planning activities is to start developing and figuring out where there is consensus about the preliminary CSM or conceptual site model, which I will also talk about a little bit more. So moving to slide 9. A little bit more in terms of some details as to what systematic planning activities involve. Once you've begun to have these initial conversations about what you're trying to accomplish and general understanding about what the data needs might be, then you can start talking about things such as demonstrations of method applicability, refining the dynamic work strategy for how you're going to collect the data. That would include what types of real-time technologies, how you're going to manage the data, how you're going to present it, and then how are you going to obtain it. So once you've figured out what you need to collect, then you have to figure out how you're going to collect it. That's essentially how it would work. So moving out to slide 10. So how would this be different than what you normally do? You probably already have these kinds of conversations, at least initially, scoping out what types of activities you need to do. The most important distinction that you're laughing. Would you not agree? I guess I should say some people do, some people don't. In best practices, there should be some dialogue with the people who are going to be reviewing the information that you're collecting before you actually start doing it. The difference between systematic planning under a triad framework is that you're really focused on spending a lot of time on what the preliminary CSM is. It's really important that everybody have an understanding of what is their vision for what the site looks like. you know, in terms of contaminant mass or what the COCs are, the media, the pathways, receptors, to be able to articulate that and to diagram out what you're seeing is really important. And then once you've done that, you can use that CSM to develop what the preliminary project design is and how, what kinds of sampling activities you need to be doing. You also get a chance to have the stakeholders express their concerns, not only with respect to the sampling activities, but also to the project as a whole, and to figure out what the decision criteria is going to be, which you'll then fold into the work plan that you're going to be generating. And then lastly, having a sense of what the QAQC is related to all of the above. So, moving to slide 11, I've talked about CSM, and some of you may be saying, I'm not sure, what do you mean when you say CSM? It can really be anything, a written graphical explanation of what you've known about the site. Oftentimes when I've run systematic planning meetings, it winds up with you drawing on a whiteboard or using existing geologic cross-sections and site history to be able to start to come up with a presentation of what people are seeing. And a picture is worth a thousand words. It can be very powerful, and you can begin to see where you have consensus or where you don't, where you see there might be some uncertainty associated with what you know about the site and where it's important. The key to the CSM is that it's dynamic, that you don't just spend the time during the systematic planning meeting to create it and then put it in a document and not revisit it again. You actually want to look at it all along the way to say, okay, now I've collected some additional information, and how has that changed what I knew in terms of what the conceptual site model is? And if you do that, what happens is you wind up optimizing what you're doing in terms of your site characterization, as well as this would go all the way through towards cleanup and subsequent long-term monitoring. So you would always be able to check back, what did I think when I started doing this, and how has that changed? So moving to slide 12. So how do you use it? Like I've said before, You use it to focus what kinds of activities you need to collect, and you also can figure out how to sequence those activities. And it can be very powerful because you can use it to post information as you're generating it, and you can constantly be updating it. And then it'll eventually become your model of the site as you're going all the way through the cleanup process. Slide 13. What are some things that go into a conceptual site model? I'm sure some of you have seen at least the risk-based conceptual site model, so it'll have things like the pathway receptor networks. What we're talking about in terms of conceptual site model also includes pretty much everything that you need to know. Some of this you can present on graphical format, and some of it you may need to have written descriptions. But it would include things like what you know about the past use, what the previous investigations have been. Oftentimes that's very surprising. People don't even look back to what kinds of information have been collected in the past. What you know about the physical system, both the geology and the hydrogeology. Things you may not be as familiar with is trying to tie in more about the planned reuse of the site. What's it going to look like? Which then ultimately drives you towards your exit strategy, which is, when are you going to be done? What's the vision for what that looks like? And from those pieces, you can start tying in, well, what do we know about potential remedies? What are my decision criteria with consideration for pathway receptor networks? So it's a lot more comprehensive than probably some of you may be more familiar with. So what I wanted to do, because we only have a little bit of time, is to just highlight a few of the ones that I thought you may not be very familiar with. And so I picked a couple, but if you have any questions about any other of those pieces of the CSM, I'd be happy to talk to them. In terms of planned reuse, why is that important? A lot of times, at least from a regulatory perspective, that may not be a driver, at least in the regulator's mind. But really, it does dictate the decision criteria. Who's going to be using the property? What will it look like? And then it can help you target what kinds of sampling activities that you need and what kinds of remedy that you need to achieve. And an example of that would be on slide 15. This is from a site in Ashland, Wisconsin. And what you could do is actually combine what you're doing in terms of redevelopment with what types of sampling activities you need to perform. So in this particular case, the developers knew that they wanted to deepen the harbor in order to allow for boat access. And so you could actually nest the site characterization and the remedial action that you're doing with respect to what was in the harbor with the development activities that are already planned. But you won't be able to do that unless you actually have a dialogue about what are those future development plans. So are there any questions on planned reuse? Moving to slide 16, decision criteria. This is one I think that people tend to get the most hung up on, is that, well, we're going to wait and tell you what our decision criteria is once we see the information. And that's okay to have that be the ultimate, you know, wait for the decision. But one of the key things that you have to do in a systematic planning meeting is to at least explore the realm of what types of criteria there might be. And there's a whole bunch of different kinds. Depending on what types of field technologies you're using, you may derive a field-based decision criteria. So, for example, with an XRF, if I go out and I have a result of 200 ppm, for example, for lead, to me, I'm going to assume that that means that that may be close to an action level that if I ran it using fixed analytics that I might want to consider. So you can use a field-based decision criteria sort of as a proxy, and then you have the bright line criteria and the regulatory criteria, risk screening criteria, risk-based criteria. Those are all ones that we're more familiar with in terms of what are my cleanup criteria for planning purposes, so risk screening. Risk-based criteria incorporates what my decision units are, my exposure units. MI sampling is often derived based on risk-based criteria like that. Any other kind of regulatory criteria that may be present based on your ARRs. And then lastly, judgmental criteria is, again, more of a field-based thing where, okay, where do I know my sources are? What am I actually seeing in the field that might want me to target sampling certain activities in certain areas? So having a discussion of what those might be, I think, is very important to be having during the systematic planning process. Once you have done that, then you can start talking about how you're going to mesh, this is slide 17, how you're meshing your decision criteria with your decision units. You start talking about what your spatial dimensions of your decision units are based on what you know in terms of the population of interest, something else, physical properties, what the planned reuse is. And then once you've begun to delineate what my decision units are in terms of can I do a single remedial action for a single area, then you can derive what a good statistical sampling design is. For example, oftentimes if you're doing yard sampling, your decision unit will be a yard. And so you want to make sure that your decision sampling is based on that decision unit and the associated decision criteria. So what would this look like? Robert, this is the Poudre River example, if you wanted to go through that.
Sure. My name is Robert Howe. I'm with Tetra Tech, and just like Tim, I've been working on triad-type projects, and particularly conceptual site models. This is slide 18. This is an example of a preliminary conceptual site model at a site that had actually been studied for 4 or 5 years. You can see it's very simple. We had a landfill, we had some potential sources up gradient, we had what looks like a some sort of dissolved phase plume, and the ultimate problem here was that there was Dean Apple exiting to the river, but there was no real connection between the source areas and what was coming up in the river. Now, the site was basically composed of a landfill, which was on top of some silty sands, which was then on top of some more alluvial gravels, and then below that a shale unit. And there had been really no exploration into the bedrock at all. But what we knew was that the dissolved phase plume didn't reach the river. And if the Dean Apple was reaching the river from these sources, one would expect that you would see some sort of a dissolved phase plume. But we did not, so we used this as kind of a starting point, and we started to investigate the landfill and other potential sources. And after our initial round of exploring the site with direct push technologies, we came up with a revised conceptual site model, which is shown in slide 19. Now, this model shows that none of the wells have really penetrated into the bedrock. You know, we were kind of envisioning that there were some layers that were keeping us from seeing the dissolved phase plume going all the way to the river. And we sort of envisioning in our own mind that maybe this Dean apple, which was basically a heavy hydrocarbon product from the former manufactured gas plants, might have been, you know, buried in the landfill in pockets or underneath the landfill or even placed near the river upstream, or just getting down onto the bedrock and then traveling along the bedrock and into the river, since we didn't know, we didn't have any wells at this point that penetrated that deeply. So that kind of led us to our next logical, part of the investigation was, well, where is this stuff? We need some deeper wells. So it actually drove us to change our technologies to go from direct push to more traditional methods. We used geophysics. We used, a series of collaborative tools, soil gas, electromagnetics, resistivity, and traditional boring, as well as trenching along the river. And surprisingly enough, what's interesting about this, if you go to slide 20, is ultimately what we found out was that indeed this material was getting down to the bedrock, and the bedrock was a little different, you know, in terms of what we had originally envisioned. It was not a consistent shale. It was went from a silty kind of material in shaley material into a more dense fractured shale. And if you look at slide 20, you can see that this Dean apple that got released out there actually made it down into this fractured bedrock. And when we trenched along the edge of the river and we found this stuff had a vertical upward gradient and was getting driven from the fractured bedrock into the river and was basically just flowing out there. So very unusual circumstance, one that you don't think really would happen, but that's what conceptual site models are all about. And that is looking at your data gaps, identifying what you need to know, what you don't know, and in this case, it led us to do some very different things than they had been doing for the last 5 years, and ultimately, we were able to design a remedy, get it in place, and understand the connection between the upgradient sources and the river that we might not have if we had had relied solely on our intuition and not put all the data together onto conceptual site models and then use that to drive how we did our examination of the site. So that's basically the evolution of this conceptual site model at this site, which allowed us to get to our end goal, which was designing and implementing a remedy at this location.
Thanks, Robert. Are there any other questions on conceptual site models? Unfortunately, we could spend an entire day going through various examples about conceptual site models and how powerful they can be. There is another session, I think it's on the 6th, that will have a couple better examples, but just what we're trying to give you is general concept as to what these would look like. Are there any questions?
Yeah, that is at the same time on Thursday this week, I'll be giving a seminar on building consensus visions using conceptual site models where we'll talk specifically about some good conceptual models that were used in a similar fashion to what we did with Pooter.
Okay.
Back to you, Kim.
All right, thanks. And while we were while Robert was talking, there was a question from Kevin about what a bright line criteria is. Before we go too much further, I guess I would say that it's any standard that's used for planning purposes and designing cleanups. Bright line criteria are usually fairly prescriptive. It could be a not to exceed value, so and it's usually based on a regulatory criteria. Like, for example, in the state of Washington, our local state regs for unrestricted contact for lead would be 250 ppm. Just on a discrete point-by-point basis, no value can exceed that. And so being aware of what the criteria is and what kind of criteria it is very important to see in order to be able to decide, well, that means I need discrete sampling versus not discrete sampling. It helps you figure out what kinds of sampling activity you need. So then any other questions before we move on? Okay, I just wanted to go through a little bit more about some key vocabulary that you will see when you're going through systematic planning purposes projects. So back to slide 21. You also heard me talk about the term exit strategy, and I just wanted to spend a little bit more time on that. Really all it is a formal plan that's going to take you all the way through. A lot of times what we do in the environmental industry is we take projects in phases, and that's okay to do, and sometimes it's from funding purposes or timing purposes, you have to do that. But what you need to do is within any phase is make sure that you understand what subsequent phases could or could not occur based on what sampling you're doing, and keep your eye on that, because then you might be able to incorporate additional data collection activities to be able to help streamline getting ultimately to site closure, whatever that looks like. And the most important thing to do in systematic planning meeting is to build whatever the consensus is in terms of what that exit strategy would look like. So that's exit strategy. Slide 22. Just to go over really one more time what the whole purpose of systematic planning is. It's all about managing risk and controlling uncertainty. So in the conversations that you have, you're going to be focused on what don't you know and how am I going to manage the risk of the uncertainty of not knowing those things. So you'll start talking about whether or not you can do real-time measurement technologies and how you're going to handle managing those using dynamic strategies. You'll talk about the uncertainties associated with schedule and cost, what-if scenarios, how much money do I have to spend, do I need to obtain insurance or not, and what is the risk associated with, am I actually going to achieve site closure, and what am I going to need to know, when will I know whether or not that's a problem? Moving to slide 23, the most important piece I want to emphasize here is that the decision uncertainty can come from a variety of different sources. I know a lot of times in more traditional sampling programs, we're focused on the data uncertainty, but there are also equally powerful, if not more powerful, drivers in terms of what uncertainty in a project is. You can have political, economic, the organizational, social uncertainties, whether or not you have stakeholder groups that are for or against certain things, if you have political pressure for certain types of future site development. If you're using a model, what the associated uncertainty is with that model, and how can you collect additional data to collaborate the model. And then you go to the more traditional uncertainties that we tend to focus on, which is the data uncertainty. How are you collecting the information, and what's the uncertainty associated with the results that you're obtaining with respect to deciding what you're going to do for a site? So moving to slide 24, this is about data quality. And I know we spend a lot of time, at least I know in Seattle we do, about analytical uncertainty because that's very easy to control. So you spend a lot of time with chemists figuring out extract methods, sample prep methods, making sure that the analysis is within control. But oftentimes when you do that, you lose sight of what the sampling uncertainties are. Did you actually collect the sample from the right place in the same, based on the decision that you're trying to make? Did you preserve it right? Was the volume right? What was the variability within the area that you were sampling, either soil variability from a spatial perspective or groundwater from a temporal perspective? And then when you combine the two, what does that make in terms of your interpretive uncertainty? How do all of those things affect the decisions I'm trying to make? For me, a very powerful example of how both sampling and analytical uncertainty can drive what you're doing is on slide 25. If you imagine using Pythagorean theorem that you have analytical uncertainty as one side of your triangle and sampling uncertainty on the other, if you look at the examples in the first case, you have low analytical uncertainty and a high sampling uncertainty, and the result would be a total uncertainty of 81 ppm. Example two, because if you spend a lot of time and effort to lower your analytical uncertainty, let's say you get it down to 5, without changing your sampling uncertainty, if you look at the total uncertainty, you didn't really change it very much at all. But if you actually kept the analytical uncertainty the same and halved the sampling uncertainty, which was actually larger to begin with, then your total uncertainty would also almost half. And if you even raised the analytical uncertainty a little bit, because it was never as big as the sampling uncertainty to begin with, you almost get the same effect. And so really the importance in systematic planning is to spend some time making sure that your sampling uncertainty is reduced as well as your analytical uncertainty. Are there any questions on that? Moving to slide 26. So how do you control that? Well, we've talked about for analytical errors, making sure that you've got the right technique. If it's not getting you what you need in terms of QC or appropriate detection limits, getting a better technique, and then improving the QC associated with the technique. Where you can have the most effect in terms of your total uncertainty may actually be in the other things, such as sampling prep, sampling errors. So making sure that you're collecting the sample right, you're collecting more samples. This is where the whole concept of MI sampling, multi-increment sampling comes in, is that if you collect more samples, then you might get a better representation of what your total value actually is and the uncertainty around that value. So, any other questions on systematic planning? So the next leg would be dynamic work strategies. And what's that? Well, really the bottom line is if you're going to be doing things real time, you need a process to be able to help you derive how to handle that. So a dynamic work strategy is any work strategy that allows you to incorporate the collection of that data real time and then feeding it back into your conceptual site model. So moving to slide 28, what are the components? You'd start to frame what the dynamic work strategy would look like during your systematic planning meeting. So things that you would talk about would be what your critical data gaps are in your conceptual site model, like we talked about earlier, and then tying what your decision criteria are with the planned reuse. And then you can begin to figure out, okay, what types of data gaps do I have, and how do I start sequencing those activities to improve efficiency? So if you have different types of equipment doing different types of activities, you would sequence those based on the mobilization of that equipment. If you have certain things that you need information on before you can decide whether or not you need to collect additional information, for example, if you want to do soil sampling, and then based on the soil sampling results, you'll decide whether or not you need to do groundwater sampling. You need to make sure that you understand how things feed one another in order to sequence the activities. Once you've identified that, then you can actually start sketching out what your decision logic diagrams would be in terms of, you know, it could either be if-then statements or flow diagrams that are going to tell you, if I see this, then I do that. It's really important when you're using real-time analytics to be able to have that delineated so that your field activities can go smoothly. And then the last piece that's important that often falls down is how you're actually going to manage that data as it's coming in. You're going to start collecting a whole bunch of information that's going to be coming in very quickly, and how are you going to manage that and communicate the information so that you can make decisions in the field real time. So the essential elements of a dynamic work strategy, slide 29. Like I said before, you need to start thinking about what the sequencing is in terms of the types of sampling that you're going to be collecting, what your schedule is, not only in terms of the different types of sampling, but also if you have a real-time, let's say a GC lab out in the field, for example, how long does it take to get throughput? And that way you can figure out, okay, well, I'm going to do this type of activity, and then I need to have a little bit of time lag in order to be able to get the information, so you can start segmenting or staggering what your field work would look like. And then tracking, making sure that you're doing everything that you said you were in the order that you said you were doing it. Things to think about, important considerations when you're developing your dynamic work strategies. This is slide 30. What your logistics are in terms of how you're going to get the data. And then lines of authority are really important with respect to who makes the decisions. There are things that you anticipated in the field, like if you have utility clearance issues, you can give the field people permission to step out, you know, in order to be able to get out from under utilities. There could be things that you didn't fully anticipate that you may be able to handle more on a higher level in terms of making sure that it matches what your ultimate goals were for exit strategies. And then there could be things that are very significant that you may even be able to have to take even further. So you need to make sure that you understand who do you call when you find what? That's an important thing that you need to identify in dynamic work strategies. And then lastly, having the documentation requirements ironed out, how are you going to document it in terms of both the work plan to make sure that everybody knows what was agreed to, and then how you're going to communicate it in the field, whether it's going to be on a website, if you're going to get daily faxes of boring logs or whatever, making sure that you know who needs what when. And then the last piece is making sure that if you're using an innovative technology, that your vendor involvement is incorporated so that you get a sense of what they know about existing site conditions, throughputs, and how you can use what they're doing if it's a non-standard application. So moving to slide 31. What are the common pitfalls? The most important piece, I would say, is you're not involving the people who actually need to contribute what they need. I've seen this a couple times where you have a regulator who is adverse to web-based technology and would really rather you sit down with them on a weekly basis and walk you through the information. If you don't get that information from them before you start the field work, you're going to go into a spiral because then you don't really have a whole lot of time to iron out what your communication is going to be while you're actually collecting it. So spending some time to make sure that you get people's perspective as how they want to have this work. If you use an untested method, you're actually testing it, doing the data collection. A lot of times you'll wind up with things that come up that you're going to have to resolve before you can move forward. So we often recommend, we call it demonstration method applicability. I think Robert's going to talk about that in a little while, ways to test field methods if they haven't been done before, either at all or on your site. You really should do that before you actually start doing the really intensive field work. The other thing that people have a hard time getting away from is prescribed sample locations. What I have seen is sort of a compromise is you can start with a map that shows the site, and you can start with, here's my initial sample locations, but you can't have all the sample locations identified on a map from the very beginning, because the whole concept of dynamic work strategies is that you're allowing the information that you're collecting to inform the when, what, and how of other information that you're going to need over time. So you need to steer clear of having all the locations being prescribed. And then lastly is not addressing either logistics or the planning for the proper data collection. That all boils down to handling the data as you're collecting it, making sure that you have enough people and enough discussion about how you're going to be communicating the information to them so that when you're doing the field work, you're not going to get caught up in trying to figure out how to present the information real time. So moving to slide 32. In terms of sequencing, like I said earlier, there's essentially two different levels of sequencing. One is a project level, so you have your traditional site characterization, design, RA sampling, the verification sampling once you're doing treatment, and then performance optimization. And being aware of how all those different pieces of the project fit in when you're doing your sequencing for whatever phase you're in at the time. And then you also have, if for a given effort, for a different site characterization effort, you may have a sequencing of activities so that first you do non-intrusive methods like GPR, or you do just a site recon or historical photographs or whatever is not requiring actual sampling. And then you can move on to the more slightly intrusive methods and then go to more widespread, and then you can even go into the localized source delineation as you're gathering more information. So just being aware of the fact that there are different levels and trying to figure out what should come first is really important when you're developing a dynamic work strategy. So given the way that we're doing this presentation today, I can't spend a whole lot of time showing you examples of a dynamic work strategy, but essentially you can often look at it as a decision logic diagram. And so what you see here on slide 33 is a very simple schematic of that, where you start, you apply a sampling scheme, you collect your samples, and then you'd have some sort of decision criteria or decision logic. Is it above or below a value? If not, I'm going to do something, and if yes, I'm going to do something different. And you, depending on your project needs, it can be as simple as an if-then statement. So if my result is above a bright line criteria, for example, then I need to step out to whatever increments we've decided on in our systematic planning meeting. There are lots of examples of these on the triadcentrals.org. I can't spend a whole lot of time on them. But the whole focus here is that you really spend your time focused on what your decision logic is going to be and not on the six locations. That you understand what types of field methods you're going to be collecting information with and how it's going to feed into the subsequent activities that you're going to be collecting. And the bottom line is when you do this, you're going to be reducing the time associated with having to remobilize over and over again. And the other benefit associated with dynamic or streamlined work plans is that you don't have to spend a whole lot of time making sure that you have everything nailed in terms of every single prescribed sample location, every single contingency. Instead, you're spending your time on the process. So if I see this, then I'm going to do that. And so oftentimes what I've heard from regulators is that by participating in both the systematic planning process as well as the developing of a streamlined dynamic work strategy, that enables them to be more fully engaged in the project so that when they do get a work plan on their desk, it's much easier for them to review and save some time. So moving to slide 34, some examples of data management, assessment, and visualization tools. You will have the data management associated with sampling, and there's a whole bunch of different electronic deliverables you can get in terms of chemistry data, geology data, probe data that's more qualitative and quantitative. And whatever information you're collecting, you need to figure out how you're going to manage that. So you have to think about what kinds of databases am I going to use, what kind of outputs, visualization, am I going to be using something to help me determine the uncertainty, like SATA as an example. I think, Robert, you'll talk a little bit about that. How am I going to be interpreting the data as I go along? And so you really need to spend some time about how that's going to happen when you're developing your dynamic work strategy. The key overall is to match what your data quality is to ultimately choosing to make a decision. So when you see in Triad, you'll see a combination of field-based methods and fixed lab methods. And it's not a line of evidence thing where you're going to use field to tell you what you think the fixed is going to be. It's more of a collaborative thing. I could use field-based methods, and then I'll use fixed methods to confirm whether or not I'm getting the information I needed. And it all relates back to what decision am I trying to make. And so based on that fundamental premise, then you can start figuring out what kinds of decision support tools and real-time measurement technologies am I going to need in order to be able to do that the best. Slide 36. Just a couple examples in terms of how you could collect and store and manage the data. There's a bunch of resources that are available to you for free. I'm sure some folks are familiar with Visual Sampling Plan. I talked a little bit about Spatial Analysis and Data Decision Assistance. That's SADA. What you can do with that is you actually put in your information, and it'll calculate for you what your uncertainty is of a certain area being above or below a bright line criteria, for example. And so as you're deciding where you're going to collect your step outs, you can put your data into SADA, or Fields, I think, also does the same thing. And it'll allow you to be able to see, okay, where is the highest uncertainty based on the information that I've just collected. In order to do that, you need to have some things that actually let you put in the information. So having good decision support tools and Scribe and Scribblers is a way that you can actually put information in a PDA so that you have a very quick way to transfer the information that you're getting from the field into whatever decision support tool you're using. Those are really great examples of how you can maximize the efficiency in the lab. And then, of course, the bottom line is always how do you communicate the results? What kinds of information will you need? Who needs it? When do they need it? So what's the importance associated with it? And what are the options in terms of, do you want it on a website? Do you want to have a sit-down? Do you want to, if you can't download information, if you're out in a remote site, how am I going to communicate the information? Maybe you need to start scheduling, here will be our check-in time, and we'll come back out of the remote location and give you the download and then go back out. There's, depending on what your site needs are, you're really going to have to spend some time talking about how to communicate what you're actually getting in the field. And so that's it for dynamic work strategies. Are there any questions on that before we move to real-time measurements? Okay, Robert, you want to take it from here?
Actually, Kim, this is Jean. Just before you guys transition, there was an online question that came in from actually Argentina, and they asked if you could provide some actual examples of uncertainty calculation and compare the traditional versus trial lab data versus XRF data.
Yes, we're going to do that in the next segment.
Okay.
Thanks, Jean.
So you finished up with slide 38?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, well, this segment on slide 39 is sort of what are real-time measurement technologies. And so if you go to slide 40, there are some very brief examples. And, of course, on Fluen you can go to innovative technologies and get a lot more information on all the different types of innovative technologies that are available in the encyclopedia there. But the thing to remember here, and I think it's very important, keeping in context the need to sequence that Kim was talking about, the need to use a heuristic or learn-as-you-go strategy, is that many of these technologies, the output is very dense information. For example, if you have downhole sensors, like the membrane interface probe that is shown on this picture here on the right of this figure, this provides almost every foot or less some type of reading from three or four different detectors, including potentially a cone penetrometer, which provides geology. And so a lot of information is coming through. And this information, you need to plan to manage that data. And it's fairly simple to do that, but you have to talk to your vendors. You have to be able to download a spreadsheet. You need a geologist out there who can, you know, input the geologic picks into your database, maybe the elevation of water levels, maybe some slightly different information than you're used to recording if you're just looking at chemistry. And it's very, you know, spatially very intensive. So you have to be prepared to capture all this information. You may want to process some of it later, but the fact is, you know, you can get this stuff electronically in a pretty simple form, but you need to have kind of figured out your preliminary conceptual site model and what hypotheses you're going to test so that you can start to select what information you want to put in your database that you will use then to evolve your conceptual site model. Because the real, you know, power of the triad is your ability to evolve the conceptual site model on a real-time basis and use information as you gather it to optimize where you place your sampling locations. Now, slide 41 talks a little bit more about terminology, talks a little bit more about some concepts that are important to developing a preliminary investigative strategy. Decision criteria are available for thousands and thousands of compounds. You might want to figure out what in general are your targets so that you know what kind of sensitivity or what kind of instruments you can use. You also would like to test the localized or small-scale heterogeneity or uncertainty at your site, and that relates to, you know, how big of a sample do you collect? If you collect samples of different sizes, do you get very different answers? If you homogenize them, if you sieve them, if you do different things, we call that sample support. And that, of course, is something that you'll test in your demonstration of methods applicability we'll talk about in just a few minutes. Practical constraints are very important when you're selecting you know, your technologies. You want to make sure that your truck's not going to sink in the sand and that it'll go to the depth that you want to go to if you're using a direct sensing tool. You want the right amount of throughput so that, you know, all your mobile lab and your sampling crews and your fixed lab can all be working together harmoniously and not one getting backed up or the other. And so during the demonstration of methods applicability, you want to test that out as well. And a demonstration of methods applicability also can funnel information into potential remedies. And so, you know, you try to keep all this information in mind. A demonstration of methods applicability is something that you use sort of as a planning tool. You want to decide, okay, what tools can we use? How much productivity will we get? And, you know, what kind of uncertainty do we suspect is there? What's the best sample preps? And you can do it either as a separate kind of little study if your methods are well established and there's a lot of track record for these and you know what they can do in your particular environment. Maybe you can just do it and refine it as you start out a project, or if there is no data and you're very concerned that a technology or an approach might not work, you might want to do a little kind of pre-writing your work plans type of a test to make sure that whatever your proposed plan is going to hold water and work. And you know, there are many things that you can test, you know, various hypotheses. For example, if you go on to slide 42, here's an example of a laser-induced fluorescence tool.
And, slide 41, Robert. One slide got taken out. That's slide 41.
Now on this slide, slide 41, it shows this laser-induced fluorescence tool, and it shows the responses that you get from these tools. And basically what you get is you have a laser that is being pushed down the hole, and as it encounters hydrocarbons, then it provides a fluorescence response. And that fluorescence response will be of different relative intensity depending on whether or not what type of hydrocarbons you have in the subsurface. And not only do you get this total intensity that's coming out, but you also get spectral information, which gives you, you know, is it a lighter product? For example, if you look at the little peaks on the right-hand side here, the very right side of this figure, you'll see that the front-end peaks are very strong, but you also have pretty good-sized peaks as you go into longer and longer wavelengths. That means that this product is probably a mixture of gasoline or diesel and motor oil, maybe all in that same range, whereas if you look at the peaks that are shown on the right-hand side of the left portion of the diagram, there you see a very strong early wavelength peak around 50 nanometers. This might indicate that this is more of a gasoline, more of a light end product. Now, during a demonstration of methods applicability and while a program is moving forward, there are things that you can do with this type of information that are a little less than obvious. Sometimes maybe your goal is to do product removal or product recovery. And you can see the dark lines that are shown on both of these figures are examples from a site I worked on, a large refinery site, where the project team was able to determine for lighter versus heavier products when they would expect to see free product in a well. And it was based strictly on the degree of total fluorescence shown along the bottom of the of those two figures. And for the lighter end, more gasoline type product, they had a 50% was their cutoff, and they developed that through observational analysis used in collaboration with the actual tool responses and the product type. And then for the heavier product, they determined a 75% response was where they would start to expect to see free product in these wells. So the power of that was, you know, as they learned to use these tools and interpret the data, collaboratively, they were able to use this to predict where they might have product without installing more expensive wells. And of course, you can install, you know, many of these pushes in a day, you know, many more than you can wells, so it was a very good cost-saving type of event. So, let me get back here. So, moving on to the next example, the next slide, which is slide 43. This is an example, there's actually two slides in here, to answer the question of uncertainty. And how do you measure uncertainty? What do you do with it? This is a case where you have lead ICP data plotted along the bottom and lead by XRF plotted on the y-axis. And what you see here is you see a scatter of information, and that scatter of information is representative of the differences between the XRF field results and the ICP lab results. And so it's actually a measure of total uncertainty in the data set by, you know, in the fact that you're comparing the two. Now, there are ways to manage this uncertainty. Usually during a demonstration of methods applicability, you do, you know, 8 to 10 points or maybe more. With XRF, you can do many more and kind of figure out, well, do we have a significant bias? Is this line, the slope of this line, greater than or less than 1? And if it's greater than you know you've got a bias. If it's less than, you've got a negative bias. And you can begin to figure out, well, why is that happening? Do we have interferences that are creating a depression of certain signals? Or do we have some other reason to believe that our XRF data doesn't exactly correlate with our field-based data? And you can go back and revise your protocols. You can even establish safety factors to determine that, you know, you want to be more safe. I don't want a lot of false positives. I would rather have false negatives. And I can handle a certain amount of those. So you can construct these safety factors around these linear regressions. And, in fact, if you go to EPA SW846, method 6200 that deals with XRF, and look in section 7, the authors have very adeptly identified information that you need to take XRF data and elevate it to a more definitive status. For example, the slope of the line, the overall uncertainty around the line, and specific factors that they have identified that are very useful for establishing whether or not your XRF data can be used in lieu of fixed lab data. So many of your field-based methods have those similar types of sections in them. They generally look at linear plots like this, but there are many other ways to look at correlations of data. And they don't necessarily have to be linear. They can be non-parametric methods. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to talk about many of the other methods. But suffice it to say, you know, when you do a demonstration of methods applicability or you're looking at uncertainty, it's good to plot the data up and look at the characteristics and have that help you redesign or modify your program real time. And skipping over 44 and going right on to sort of back to this idea of quality assurance and data management and how all these things go hand in hand with the triad, this picture shows that not only do you have the tools like we spoke about, the field-based tools, but you have a series of other tools that you may want to consider to try to accelerate your ability to process information real time. And of course, the best way to do that is to get a program where, or get a project designed around electronic deliverables. For example, up in the collect data portion of this circle, we have Scriblets. It's an example of a program that was developed by EPA Emergency Response Team. And that program has PDAs or microcomputers that allow you to enter site information, locations from GPS, sample logs, a lot of different information, and that information can be then directly downloaded to a database, a relational database. And a relational database is essentially, could be as simple as Access. It could be one that has some more structure to it, like Scribe, which is compatible with Scriblets in the ERT program, that has fields and data dictionaries built in it that allow you to quickly process not only chemical data, but also data from, field-based instrumentation, like your LIF or your membrane interface probe, and your standard chemical data that you might get from a mobile laboratory. Get that all processed, and not only processed, but you want to do some QA/QC evaluation of the reliability of that data real time to make sure that it's useful for decision-making purposes. So when you're doing the triad, not only is it better to use electronics to get going, but it's also important to use the database as a field check to make sure that as you're going along, there's not some big busts or problems with your data before you communicate them or try to make decisions with them using a decision support tool as shown in here, like Maros or Visual Sampling Plan or SATA, and then communicate that information, the results of your daily activities or your weekly activities, to your stakeholder group, because you certainly want to be careful that the information you're presenting is sufficiently reliable to share. So this is an important slide. It really shows the kinds of things you need to do. In my opinion, this is where people fall down the most when trying to use the triad. They don't try to manage their data aggressively on a real-time basis using a series of well-planned tools or well-designed framework of tools. And so their data languishes for a long period of time, and at the end of the day, they wind up not getting the critical information that they may need. So if I were going to stress anything to people who want to try to use the triad, it would be understand your data streams, manage them aggressively while you're in the field, use the visualizations to manage uncertainty, because BFP, for example, and SATA can be used to do geostatistical plots. It can be used to look at uncertainty not only in a two-dimensional sense like we did with the DMA, but also in a three-dimensional sense before you start communicating results, and that will be extremely helpful to you, I think, as you move forward. Slide 46, this talks about the sequencing, and what are those things that are different about the triad framework. Sequencing is a key because of the learn as you go. It's key because it allows you to optimize your sampling locations. You don't need to just have a static grid and then stand back and say, oh, gee, I missed all these things. So the sequencing is critical to getting it right the first time, to improving efficiency. using collaborative data sets, sets that include less specific technologies like the LIF or the MIP, in combination with perhaps field lab and fixed lab results to get a clearer picture of where you're going. Having the decision criteria, working through the systematic planning process, you can streamline work plans, and you've got to add, you know, a little bit more robust data management and communication strategy in there if you want it to work once you get in the field. And, of course, ultimately, you can manage uncertainty better and costs and get additional information for the remedies and tie those into the reuse if you manage all this stuff successfully. But it's a real challenge in the data management area, and people need to take that seriously. Slide 47.
It's actually 46 for those who are following on the website.
Okay,
so you're always off by one. That's okay.
I'm off by one. Okay. So 46 is what is a successful characterization? How do you make sure that you're going to do this? Well, I mean, other than doing the data management piece, it's sequencing and load balancing and cost-benefit analysis that you need to use to sort of design your program, make sure it's going to give you the benefits that you're looking for. You use a collaborative data and a DMA to sort of test how things going to go. You do quality assurance on the fly. I mean, maybe it's not the ultimate quality assurance, but it's enough to make the data, you know, give you some confidence in your data. And then you also try to plan on contingencies. What happens if one tool doesn't work and I have to go to another? Like we had to do at Pooter, where we had to go from direct push to more traditional drilling. And then how am I going to communicate all this information? I mean, all these things should be things that you're thinking about when you're going forward in designing your plan. Now, slide 47, how is cyber media and reuse under the Triad framework different? It's not really different. You just do it better because you understand your site better. You're able to write remedial action plans that are more you're more confident that the results will be reliable. You know, if you're selling properties that can have some impacts on insurance because you know what the site conditions are, if you're trying to insure a property, you can look at the decisions that you have more clearly. And ultimately, even as you get into optimization of a remedy that's implemented, you can do a better job of short-term and long-term cost estimation. So having high-resolution site characterization information and even remedy implementation information has a trickle-down effect that will help you throughout the entire life cycle of your project. Figure 48, remedy design and implementation using the Triad. We mentioned some of these things. I think that suffice it to say, when you have high-resolution characterization information, it's going to help you throughout the remainder of the process that you're going to be involved with. Slide 49, this is an example of sort of what Kim was talking about, how there are different cycles, natural cycles, or we call them stages in projects, where you go from, say, an ROI phase or stage where you have risk is the main element of concern. You want to know, do I have concentrations that pose a risk? And if so, where are they approximately? And from the left-hand side of this figure, this is an example of the results of an RI from a chlorinated solvent plume, and you can see there was a pretty good little bullseye and pretty good concentrations. They knew that in this case they had concentrations that were high enough to be indicative of Elm apple, based on their observations in wells as well as their concentrations measured in soil and in groundwater. But as they moved to the electrical heating design element of this project, it became very apparent that they needed additional information to optimize the design. And so they naturally moved from this risk evaluation stage to an area where it made a lot more sense from a cost and performance standpoint that they go in and put in a lot more wells and or electrical resistivity heating elements. And you can see that they really sort of pincushioned with, by comparison, the treatment area. And as they went into that, their focus became more the physical properties of the media and the source term. It was part of a performance-based contract, so it was based on a lump sum to do the work. And the contractor developed a whole different need for data on a higher density. And it turned out to be a very successful project where they were able to remediate this Dean apple plume quite rapidly. And it's so it's part of the natural progression that you'll see, and the data densities will change, and your whole decision logic, your whole systematic plan, everything will evolve as you naturally move from a risk-based sort of evaluation to a remedy design, to a remedy implementation, and ultimately to long-term O&M and optimization of long-term monitoring strategies. So the triad applies through all those stages, you know, it's just a matter of how you go through the systematic planning process as you get those phases or stages, you know, what type of things that become important. Now, figure 51, that just shows some generalized, you know, benefits or measures of success. You know, certainly the remedy optimization is a huge one from a cost standpoint.
Robert,
you're able to evaluate the decision logic, refine your decision logic, maybe make your program more efficient. Slide 51.
Wait, Robert, before you go on, it seems like there's a little bit of confusion. If you're online right now, he was just talking about slide 50, but if you had downloaded the presentation before yesterday, you're one ahead of us. So depending on where you're at, you're going to hear different slide numbers. So maybe in order for
us to... I'll announce the title then.
Yeah, just announce the title.
Yeah, this is the second slide in the measures of success. You know, and this is the really important one about the triad and doing better characterization during all stages of development, and that is, you know, no surprises, no hopefully going back and redoing something because you didn't get the information you expected. You know, maximum protectiveness of the potential stakeholders, extra confidence, those things are all very important. So going to the next slide, projects best suited for the triad approach. This is a question we get a lot of times, and it's a very important question because, you know, not all projects are suited for this type of an approach, although I'd like to think that most are. You know, ones that are best suited are usually the tough ones, you know, that you have past investigations that have had limited success, you have a lot of uncertainty on where your sources are, heterogeneity as a result of either geology or contaminant distribution mechanisms is high, and you want to get there as quickly as possible, or a remedy is not working, and and you want to figure out why it's not working. So that would be a good list of sort of the best projects, candidates for being the triad type projects. Projects that are not well suited for the triad approach, sites where the schedule is in and the procurement of the resources has already happened, you know, where it's difficult to get in and change the strategy, to rethink it, to do a demonstration of methods applicability. Projects that are halfway downstream are very difficult to corral unless you can say, you know, put the skids on it, let's reevaluate this, this is not going where I want to go, and give yourself some more time. Sometimes contracts and or programs do not permit the use of certain types of innovative technologies or the use of that data. Obviously, those are not good candidates for triad-type projects because we like to use those things collaboratively. And, you know, there are also contaminants, for example, for which there are not innovative technologies that are applicable or readily usable, or the DMA may show that they're not effective. So there are many, you know, kind of warning signs that you want to have your project fit into some of those categories. In terms of opportunities for using the triad approach, shown in slide 55 or 54, depending on where you are, optimally it's best to use it from the beginning to the end, but many projects are already even beyond the characterization phase, they're going into design phase. It's never too late to interject, I think, the triad approach in to improve your vision of the site. Certainly they work, it works within most of the regulatory programs during the different stages of regulatory advancement of projects towards closure. I don't think there are too many where it precludes the use of the triad. In terms of items to verify before starting a triad project, this is sort of that hit list of what do I need to know so I don't get in trouble. Hopefully your statement of work is not in place that restricts you in terms of what you do, how you do it, and when you do it. If it just says, you know, install 5 wells or install 30 borings or, you know, investigate a location, if it's that generic, then you can always work within that time frame and try to come up with a dynamic work strategy and manage your project in a dynamic fashion. But if it's all set in stone, then you're going to have some issues there. You need some subject matter experts, and this is highly critical that you work with your vendors as well as have some expertise somewhere in your company or within your project team that's experienced at doing these things we're talking about, because if you don't, it's going to be a painful and slow process, and you're not going to be as successful or able to anticipate the issues that arise with using these technologies. And so that, to me, is extremely important. Good to have stakeholders who cooperate. They have a lot of good information. Sometimes things that you wouldn't anticipate are important, they know about. Get the procurement staff involved. Make sure that they buy into the general nature of the procurement or the design of the program. Identify any regulatory or political barriers, preconceived notions that people have about the use of innovative technologies, and then manage towards those so that you can try to, you know, meet them at the pass or cut them off before they become big issues.
Robert, this is Jean. I just wanted to do a time check, but you know you're on 55, 54. We've got about 35 minutes left.
Great. So getting started writing a request for proposal, how do you do that if you want to do a triad project? Well, slide 57 or 56, whatever, you know, you version you have, is the preliminary CSM. That is the key. You've got to have some version of a preliminary CSM and some idea of what it is you're going to look for, why you're going to look for it, and you have to have somebody who's got the experience and knows the key type of people he's looking for to make this project go. And as you move farther onto the more advanced stages of a project in design, or, for example, in that case example I showed from the TNAPL site, you're actually in the remedy implementation phase. You know, what factors are you going to use to evaluate remedy effectiveness? In the case of the electrical heating, they used temperature as one of the controlling factors, where the contractor was on board to raise the temperature of the soil in the source area to a certain temperature so that they could be sure to mobilize as much of that product to be removed as possible. So your evaluation factors, is it going to be, you know, risk related? Is it going to be remedy related? Is it going to be optimization related? And what is the schedule? Because the schedule will drive your productivity and many other things. So moving on to writing a statement of work to slide 58 or 57, have specific goals and objectives. These have got to be really concrete, not vague, very direct. You know, determine the source of DNAPL impacting the river. I mean, that was a very clear objective we had with the Poudre River site. You know, clean up the DNAPL to less than concentration X that we determine will not be a continuing source to groundwater. Those would be specific objectives. How will those then, you know, what real-time measurements then do you want to use? Say you want to, in general, use these type of remedies or ask people to propose on remedies or technologies and use that to evaluate their understanding of the problem and their ability to manage real-time data. There has to be some statement in there about that. And how do they plan to communicate some sort of a strategy? All these things are kind of redundant with what we talked about before and need to come out when you're trying to procure services to do the triad type of work. Evaluating written responses, slide 59 or 58, should stress the importance of systematic planning. And it's very common that people don't spend the time to really think through their process and through their end goals and objectives. They tend to just jump into what they know and do what they need to know right now first. And that is a way for decreasing the efficiency of a project, requiring more time in the field. You need to try to think as far as you can, put on the, and look into the crystal ball, to put on your thinking cap, and project as far as you can into those things like Kim talked about with, you know, reuse and performance, you know, all those things you want to get out of a project, and really do your homework up front at every stage in a project's life cycle so that, you know, when you go out there, you can be as efficient as you can. And, of course, when you get these written responses back from people proposing on your scope of work, you will see whether or not they are addressing these types of issues. And if they're not, that might be questions to go back to them with and say, you know, what about this? Moving on to selecting a qualified contractor, you know, this is where you want to look at a company's quals. You want to look at their past experience. You want to look at, you know, what type of data management skills do they really have and capabilities. Have they ever used any of these decision support tools we talked about earlier, like SADA or others that can help you manage uncertainties. If they haven't, or they don't have anything like that, I would be skeptical of whether they'd be able to implement a triad project real time and really gain the benefits of using a sequenced approach to limit costs and make sure that the certainty of decisions is improved. Moving on, what are some of the pitfalls, slide 61 or 60? If you have a poorly structured RFP, that doesn't help you. If it's too prescriptive, it's inflexible. As we said before, if they don't have experience with real-time data collection, the use of data collaboratively, and they're not familiar with data assessment techniques, like those needed for doing demonstration of methods applicability or looking at geostatistics in a simplified manner to understand spatial uncertainty, then I'd be a little skeptical of their ability to perform on a triad project. So slide 62, where do you go for help? This is an information guide, a procurement guide that I wrote with EPA, and there's also another one on assessing contractor capabilities. These are good documents that provide good examples of how-tos, how do you go about doing, procuring triad-type services. And to go to the next two slides, those give you some examples of the types of case studies that you can find, slides 63 and 64, or 62 and 63, depending on whether you downloaded it earlier. There are many more that you can find, some better than others for a particular application, and I would strongly suggest that, you know, if you have a question and need a good case study to help you design your program, that you contact us or contact EPA through the Brownfields Tech Support Center and request some support through their program, because they provide a series of experts that can help you find good case studies for you to do a better job with the site that you may be working on. So just as a final wrap-up, we've got some myths here that, things that we've heard from people, and, you know, they don't really understand what we're talking about when we say the triad. Slide 65 or 64 is the first of those myths, and, of course, Gina Crumbling has published a paper on this entire subject as well. But, the first one is the triad approach is nothing new. And, of course, it is quite a bit of something new. It's an integrated and harmonious framework of site cleanup, and we have been struggling over the last 10 years to really evolve a series of case studies that helps people understand sort of how all these elements go together, because it's not all that simplistic, and there are not that many people out there doing it as effectively as we would like. But it is something new. There are new technologies emerging all the time. It's very difficult to keep up with those technologies. And so it's very important for you to, you know, try to reach out to ClueIn and reach out to the people here with the technology innovation branch and keep up to date with these things, because there's always something new, just like with the IT industry, that could help you that you may need to know about. The next myth is 67 or 66, the triad approach increases workloads. The triad approach overall decreases workloads, as you can see from slide 68. It's something where during the field event, you have a very intense burn, and that you need to be staffed up a little bit more than you might think of for a more traditional or slower moving project. But ultimately, you get to your endpoints, you know, shortly after you leave the field. So in the long run, it decreases workloads dramatically. And in terms of planning documents and those types of things, because you use a dynamic or sequence strategy, you wind up with less endless tables with prescribed locations and just a few good logic diagrams that drive the program. You might have a little bit more in terms of data management, but overall, I think the Triad project is going to decrease your overall workloads.
You know, in the interest of moving to allow time for questions, I don't know if we want to just skim through the rest of the myths or if folks want to just read them on their own. I think they're fairly self-explanatory.
Sure.
So if we could just move to the resources page, just so people have a sense, that would be slide 78 if you're online and 79 if you're not, that these are just some resources to gather some more information, either about Triad itself, the Triad Resource Center, triadcentral.org has the good case studies, and the FRTR website actually has a lot of the free downloadable data support tools if folks want to begin to explore that. It's an excellent website.
Yeah, and I think there's two myths that we should talk about a little bit. I think one is an important one. It's shown on slide 76 or 75. The Triad approach generates data that is suitable for risk assessment. This is always a big question, and I think the thing to keep in mind here is that the Triad allows you to focus in and know where you can estimate risk by using collaborative data. It doesn't replace the need for definitive results necessarily, unless you can show that your field data is definitive, of high enough quality to be definitive. But it does make sure that you haven't missed anything. And so I think there's some misconception that Triad is not good for risk assessment. Triad is, in my opinion, absolutely necessary to do a good job of risk assessment. And I think the other myth that I think is very important, and a lot of us know we live in a very litigious society, but a Triad project will not withstand legal scrutiny. Well, Triad projects make it very easy in a lot of cases to understand sites and to make very complex issues and boil them down to very simple pictures or representations of the site. And when you're dealing with legal scrutiny and with court cases, simplifying complex issues is essential. So that's all I have to say about those. I think those are the last important ones, and if there are any further questions, go to the last slide, and we'll take those now.
Well, Robert, there was a question that was posted online from Argentina asking to repeat the technology, the XRF technology reference, back when you were on the slide with the lead case study, would be my guess.
Yes, if he wants to know exactly where to get the information on XRF and making that data, taking XRF data and making it or verifying that it can be used as definitive data, that comes out of EPA SW846. Method 6200, and it's in section 7. I believe it's 7.8, but I'm not sure. But there are also other good technical bulletins that you can get to. There's one that's published, and it's on CLUIN, on demonstrations of methods applicability. I highly suggest that you go look at that one. The information that's provided in method 6200 is statistically oriented. It basically talks about the the R values around a linear regression need to be greater than 0.7 for the data to be considered viable for use as a screening level, and greater than 0.9 to be used as definitive data. But it also mentions that you have to do a number of other statistical tests. And those statistical tests are standard statistical tests that you can find in many EPA references, but we also have other publications if you're interested. We can follow up and give you some examples of the types of statistical tests that you use to verify that the data are reliable, because you don't just use the linear regression. You also have to use quality assurance, quality control information, and you have to use some basic, simple, one sample t-testing as well. So,
Great, Robert. This is Jean. There was another comment or question in reference to slide, I think it's 78 or 77, with the URL for FRTR. They're just indicating a correction that it should be FRTR.gov, not FRTR.org.
Okay. So FRTR is a good resource for a lot of things, particularly related to selection of tools and
there's also, for those of you on the phone lines, if you'd like to actually take your phone off mute and ask the question to the speakers directly, you're welcome to do so. If you've muted your line right now, you can hit pound 6 to take your phone lines off of mute and just simply state your name or your location and feel free to speak up and ask a question.
Looks like we apologize for the rough sound type. Obviously, that was a bit of an annoyance for folks, and we'll try to improve that on the next few ones that we do. In terms of someone's asking here about some sources of case studies for lead remediation, there's the Ross Metals case study, which is on Cluin. There are many other case studies that deal with lead. Lead is a big issue in terms of excavation programs. And, of course, the triad is very important, especially using XRF for lead that, in optimizing what you do there. I know that Kim had worked on Fort Lewis case study that had a lot to do with lead from small arms firing ranges. There are a number of ITRC guidance documents, the Interstate Technology Resource Conservation Commission has published an entire series on small arms firing ranges. You can find a lot of good information on lead sites there.
Yeah, and because the amount of information is fairly large, if the person who's asking that question wants to contact either myself or Robert, we might be able to help direct you a little better. The case study on Fort Lewis, as Robert said, is a small arm firing range, so it involves removing bullets as well. We also have experience in diffuse plumes from mining facilities, so depending on what you're looking for, if you want to write to either one of us, we could help direct you better.
Again, if there's anyone on the phone lines and you have any comments or questions, feel free to speak up. If you muted your line, hit pound 6. I don't hear anyone else on the phone lines asking any questions, and I don't see any more that are coming in online. Kim or Robert, did you guys have any other closing comments you'd like to make?
From my perspective, I just want to thank everybody for sitting in and encourage you to risk it and try to use these approaches. Even if you don't have a lot of experience, you can get that experience through hands-on, experimentation. And I think ultimately in the end that you'll find that many of these new tools and these approaches will be beneficial to you in the long run. And, you know, building your knowledge base now is essential to being more successful as you move forward. And thank you very much for listening in. And tune back in on Thursday. We'll talk about conceptual site models in some more detail, and we'll also talk about some interesting new decision spreadsheets that are being used to sort of build consensus vision among stakeholders. So, and don't miss the rest of the presentations this month. They are presented by some of the real experts in their field. I know I'll be tuning into them because I didn't get to go to all of them at the conference, and I think they'll be well worth your time and effort.
And the only thing I guess I would add to what Robert was saying is that if there are any folks that are either federal or state agencies that are looking to implement this on their projects, if you want technical assistance from EPA headquarters, you can go to the Brownfields website, the www.brownfieldstsc.org, that was on slide 78, or you can contact myself or Robert directly, and we can hook you in terms of ways that you can get technical support for free. So that's a really good thing that EPA headquarters is offering. And then I guess, Jean, if you just wanted to walk through the last slide.
I'd be happy to. So for those of you who are still with us, thank you very much for participating and hanging in. Regardless of the format of the slides that you're viewing, go to the very, very last slide, either 80 or 81, and you'll have two important links there. The first one is the links to additional resources where you'll be able to download today's seminar presentation in its entirety in a few different formats, as well as it has additional resources and references that were discussed today. We'll add some additional links based off of some of the other URLs and items that were discussed by the speakers. So if you want to check back this afternoon or tomorrow, there will be some additional documents posted there. You have the chance to sign up to get alerts as well through TechDirect and our other notice features on Clue-In to find out when we have upcoming training available. The second link on that last slide is our feedback form. It takes just a minute or two to fill out. If you could just let us know how we did, what you thought of the presentation, the delivery method. And if you'd like to get a confirmation email to keep as a copy of your training records, some people find that helpful when they're doing documentation for CEUs or PDHs, you can also obtain one of those confirmation emails after you complete the feedback form. So we do appreciate it, and I can assure you I will be personally reading all of your comments, and I will thank you if you take the time to fill that out. I want to thank the speakers and the Tri Community of Practice for their time today, as well as all the members of the audience who participated. We do hope that you found this was a valuable usage of your time. We apologize for the bit of a disconnect between some of the slide numbers and some audio problems that some of you may have had early on. But the entire event was recorded and will be made available for free download and replay on clue-in.org in approximately 2 weeks. You can download a PowerPoint with the audio embedded. You can even subscribe to our podcast for free through iTunes and actually have the latest seminars as soon as they're posted delivered right to you on your computer. So I encourage you to go to clue-in.org/training and sign up for that service if you haven't done so already. And as Robert and Kim mentioned, this is just one, the very first one, in a 7-part seminar series that we're hosting here on Clue-In as part of Tide Month in August. The very next seminar will be this Thursday, August 6th. It's going to be session number 2 on Tribe Communications and Systematic Planning. That one is scheduled to begin at 11 a.m. and run until 1 p.m. Eastern Time. If you haven't already signed up for that seminar series, please go to clue-in.org/training and sign up, because I think we still do have a few spots left. Again, with that, I'd like to thank everybody for their time today. I do appreciate and look forward to reading your feedback, and I hope to see you again on another Clue-In Internet seminar very soon. I'm going to end the call now and hope everyone has a great day.